welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. I just had a few seconds here of panic when I couldn't get into my own studio. I'm proud to be here with you tonight. I want to welcome two fantastic guests, and I'm calling one more, so don't go away. Hi, Professor. How are you, by the way?
I'm good.
Good.
Who are
good.
We calling?
We're calling Joe.
Okay.
Kaiser Pediatrics, this is Madeline. Can I help you?
Oh, no, that's not right. That's the wrong number. I'm. That was weird. Joe gave me a wrong number to call. Isn't that hysterical? All right. First of all, let me just announce that I am talking right now to Professor David Morrell. How are you, Professor David Morrell?
I'm good. I always have to laugh when you call me professor. I was, in fact, a professor, but... you know, it's been a while.
Well, but let's talk to everybody about that, because yes, indeed, you were a professor, but you were a professor of English literature. So that's exactly
yes.
why I say that. Where did you study, Professor?
Well, it was American literature. I like to, you know, maybe be a little more focused on it. It's an odd story because I was raised in Canada. I was born and raised in Canada in Southern Ontario, a small twin city, then small, called Kitchener-Waterloo, which is now a big tech company or a big tech area. And I had in college fallen in love with a book by a man named Philip Young, the first book about Hemingway. And he wrote so remarkably well that, it's hard to imagine a professor writing so well that somebody would say, I'm going to leave Canada and go to Penn State where this man taught and study with him. But that's what happened. And that's why
wow.
I'm in the United States now after, you know, because of him. And Penn State, it was the institution that invented something called American Studies, which is the use of literature and music and movies and television and advertising and history and anything else you can think of to combine to help us understand, let us say, the Depression. And so the multi-focus that I was taught, it was so liberating that I later decided that I would teach it. And so I was at the University of Iowa teaching essentially American Studies for 16 years.
Well, I'm going to get the loop to your Yoda on the phone now. For those of you who are not aware, this is going to be a very special night. David Morrell, for those of you who don't know, David Morrell is a lot of things, but first of all, he is a fantastic New York Times International best-selling author. He is really the father, I guess, of Rambo, the character Rambo. He also wrote what I consider the seminal spy novel that combined not only English spies, but the first time we ever got to see American spies in such a way. My favorite book of all time called The Brotherhood of the Rose. It was just an amazing piece of work. David's list of things that he's accomplished throughout his life is magnificent and long, but it includes the fact that he is a co-founder of the International Thriller Writers Organization. And as a matter of fact, this July, I will be seeing him again there in New York City when Thriller Fest takes place. That is the largest gathering of thriller or mystery writers from around the world. I could tell you so many other things about him, but most recently his novels about English opium eater Thomas De Quincey have been a spectacular, amazing event. They are Victorian historical thrillers that were so heavily researched that we thought we kind of lost the professor there for a while.
No, I'm here. I'm wondering what's going on. Are we listening to a fax machine ring, or what's going on
nope.
in the background?
No, I'm going to tell you in just one half a second.
Okay.
The other half of this program is with noir crime fiction writer Joe Clifford. Joe kind of burst on the literary scene when he wrote a book called Lamentation when we were first introduced to him. And the noise you hear in the background is Joe and his kids who are playing. Is that not right, Joe?
Yeah. We had a slight emergency, and I pick up Jax. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes. Where are
you?
Okay,
the emergency?
So I had to pick up Jackson. just a pickup child emergency with my wife. Cross up. So I'm on my way home with my son. So I'm a little behind. I'm talking
okay.
to you on a speakerphone. I apologize.
Okay. Well, that's okay. Do you want to call into the studio when you get home? Are you far away from home?
About 5 minutes.
Okay, so I'm tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to send you the call-in number for the studio. And
okay.
when you get home, you give us a call, okay? I'll keep an eye out for you.
Okay, thanks so much, guys.
Okay. All right, bye-bye.
Keep an ear out for him.
Right.
I was just, this reminds me of live television.
You never know what's going to happen.
It's live radio.
It really is. In my studio, it's a virtual studio, and I have a switchboard, so I will see when his
when he calls in
number comes up. Yes, David, last time I spoke to you, you had finished up the third book in the De Quincey series, and you were taking a little bit of a break. It sounded to me, and it was hard for me to believe, but you were tired. You've been doing a lot of writing and a lot of research for your Victorian historical thrillers.
Yes.
What's been happening with you since?
Well, what happened is that for 7 years, I got to live in 1850s London. And I the research, some of our listeners may know a book by Jack Finney called Time and Again. And another book by Richard Matheson called Bid Time Return, which became a popular movie called Somewhere in Time. And in both
yes.
of those, the main character, through intense imagination, is able to either actually go back to a previous time, or else is able to convince himself that he is back there. In any case, you know, as I once mentioned to you, the reason I wrote those three Victorian books, Murder is a Fine Art, Inspector of the Dead, and Ruler of the Night, is that my granddaughter had died in 2009 from a rare bone
yes.
cancer that also killed my son. And I just wanted to escape. So for those 7 years, I granting the motive for why I wanted to trick myself into thinking I was back there, it was a delightful time. And anyhow, I knew I was only going to do three books, and I finished. And then reality struck. It was at the end of Somewhere in Time, Christopher Reeves looked around and discovered that he's now where he started in the present, and he just... It's like he freaks out, and I just had a intense reaction to the modern world, and it sounds very bizarre, but in the 7 years that I'd sort of been away, the tone of the country had gotten really low, and I just everything seemed everybody wanted to fight, and the emotions were so ugly, and so I said to hell with it. I didn't know who my audience was, and so for a year I'd been working for 46 years. For a year I worked on me, And, you know, there's a fellow named Mason Williams who years ago used to write for television for the Smothers Brothers, and he had a book of sayings, and one of the book was, one of his sayings was that he worked and worked and worked on his writing, and it was good, and then after a while he took some time off and he worked on himself, and by God, the writing got even better. So that's what I've been doing, and last September, I did start something new. It's a contemporary novel, and it's based, I can't talk too much about it, but it's based upon something very emotional and meaningful and positive that happened to me, and that I hope to communicate in a thriller context with lots of action and suspense. So that's what I've been doing.
Did it feel good to start writing again in that way?
Well, a lot of your listeners are writers, so I will say that writing is a perishable skill. And to take a year off required me to retrain myself. It did not come back as if I had just interrupted myself the day before. And all kinds of skills that I'm known for, the speed, the dialogue, the action, I had to, as it were, retrain myself. And so that took a couple of months, but I had what I wanted to write about, the experience that I wanted to memorialize, as it were, in a book, was so powerful that I persisted, even though there were some days when I was saying, you know, this is maybe like writing a novel for the first time. It's damn hard.
Right, I imagine. Well, I'm glad that you wrote, because I mean, I have all your books. I've told you that since you and I've known each other.
You're wonderful.
I kind of miss the morale touch on books, so I'm really thrilled that we'll be getting something from you soon. I want to go back and reintroduce my second guest tonight, and then I think you're in for a treat, folks, because I'm going to step away from the microphone, and these two terrific artists are going to speak to each other. Joe Clifford came to his storytelling chops in a completely different way than David Morrell did. He spent years as a homeless junkie in San Francisco and finally got off the streets and turned his life around. He earned his master's in fine arts from Florida International University North, of school I'm very proud to know very well in Miami, and then went back to the Bay Area, where he resides with his wife and two sons, Holden and Jack, and you heard Joe briefly mention that there was a little emergency with Jack. I hope everything's okay. We'll find out. His autobiographical novel is called Junkie Love. One of I can't tell you how to describe this book, except that when I read it, it was full of sadness, emotion, humor, and finally kind of a resurgence of a life. It was just a really amazing book. Since then, Joe has written for Ocean View Publishing the most spectacular set of books, Lamentation being the first, but you know him through his Jay Porter noir crime fiction thriller series. I'm very proud to welcome back to the show Joe Clifford. Joe, welcome back, and welcome to. I'm so glad you're here with David Morrell.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for covering me, Pam. I apologize, David. So, the dangers of having a wife in private school sometimes. Things go wrong.
Anybody who's raised kids knows that sometimes the pickup doesn't always happen the way it should.
Yeah, when she gets stuck in a meeting and I was trying to race back here, and of course you're catching every red light, and you're catching, you know, everybody,
well,
you know, in a truck who's slowing down, and kind of nuts.
Well, but to be fair, you know, your wife and kids come first before your interview.
Absolutely.
And it's not like you and I don't know each other. You know, it's absolutely fine. I want to also say that today is. Are you on a speakerphone, Joe?
No, I'm not on a speakerphone. There's for some reason there's a horn going crazy behind my house.
Okay.
So
can tell this is not going to be an easy interview with you. You always challenge me whenever you're on the line. I want to also mention that. that today is the release for Broken Ground, Joe's current book, the new book in the Jay Porter series. This is book number 4, correct?
This is book number 4, yes.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, it's
Broken Ground.
Thank you.
Is available on all retailers. You know where to go and find it. And having read all of Joe's books in this series, I can tell you that it is a very gritty, a very bleak at times, sometimes humorous, but a very, very raw look at someone's life in a part of that is so atmospheric because of the location. Congratulations on the book, Joe. It's terrific.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That. It's pretty exciting.
I concur. This might be a good way to, you know, I read the book way before it was published, and this might be a good time to, the note I sent to Joe's publisher about it said the following: an estate recycler picks up the fragments of his life by helping others to pick up theirs. What a brilliant noir concept. And Broken Ground, the newest addition to the terrific Jay Porter series, has brilliant writing to match. The vividness of the New Hampshire winter setting, the importance of the novel's theme, Joe Clifford's a crime writer to pay attention to. And I'm hoping we can explore a couple of those things.
Well, with that beautiful segue, I am turning over the microphone to David Morrell and Joe Clifford. Folks, you're only going to hear this one time, and you're going to hear it. This is Yoda and Luke Skywalker talking, and I'm
I'll
so honored.
Back.
There you go. I'm so glad that you got the reference. I am so glad that you're doing this on my show. Professor Morrell, I'm going to let you go ahead and take the microphone,
okay.
And
well,
I'm listening.
What I wanted to do, because Joe and I have been kicking this back and forth, and he said, you know, he was thinking about interviewing me, but I know about me, I'm kind of curious. One of the things about this book, Broken Ground, that just grabbed me was the unusual degree of reality I felt in it. In an age when a lot of thrillers are starting to look really kind of like TV movies. Not all of them, I'm not trying to badmouth, but this is a book that stood out for me because I felt I was actually there. And so I wondered if Joe could talk a little bit about his approach to New Hampshire, to the how this unusual degree of realism is possible for him.
You know, when I started writing the Jay Porter books, my one goal was to tell, you know, much like Junkie Love was my idea, was to tell the story of what Pushing was really like. I wanted to tell the story in Lamentation series, you know, with Jay, about what it's like to be a guy like Jay. And I know people like happy endings and people like hope, and those are good things. I like them too, don't get me wrong. But I've known a lot of guys like Jay. Jay is actually based on my half-brother, Jay Streeter, and he worked in the state clearing in northern New Hampshire. He's a great guy, but he's one of these guys who no matter what he does, you know, he gets $900 in the bank, his transmission blows. He can never get a leg up. He's one of the hardest working, most decent guys, but he's just always behind the eight ball. So when I wrote that was my original, that was the impetus for writing it. But as I began writing the character more and more, I realized, you know, Jay was a guy who's kind of the, you know, it's almost like a one-eyed king. He's probably the smartest guy in his town, but that's not saying much. It's a pretty low-hanging fruit because it's a town that's, you know, stuck in the mountains. It's cut off. It's like this little enclave that, you know, it has its own rules. And so, you know, when you have something that cold, and that's why I said it in New Hampshire, because I want that really inhospitable, that unfertile, that, you know, just unforgiving, relentless cold where you have to hard scrabble for your existence. And so Jay is not somebody who's going to be, you know, I love, you know, Lee Child and Jack Reacher, and I love, you know, the big heroes, I love the Marlowes, but Jay's not that guy. Jay's not a more than, he's kind of a less than. And that's how I want to tell the story. It was very important for me to tell the story from that perspective. And it's, you know, and you take some hits when you make that decision, but, you know, I feel like, the truth of what I'm trying to do couldn't be told any other way.
Well, back up. What do you mean you took some hits?
Oh, well, I am a rather thin-skinned. I mean, I'm, after all this years writing and doing what I've been doing, you'd think I'd get better at taking criticism.
It's not a survival mechanism if you're a writer, right? I mean, the rejection is everywhere.
Well, you know, what's funny is Lucasian just got translated into Italian. And the same thing that the Americans have asked me for, like, it's unrelentingly bleak and it's dismal and it's so dreary. The Italians are going, oh, my God, this is great. This is what life is really like. People don't always win. You know, sometimes people are just losers. And it's funny to see how two cultures approach the same character. You know, it's strange. But yeah, I think you're right. I think we're in a time right now where people don't want necessarily too much dour. There's so much dour in the real world. I think you look to your fiction maybe for a little escapism. And so, you know, so it's a big timing
on my part. I'm not so sure. The problem I'm having is that in an age where every other book seems to have an unreliable narrator and seems to be a version of the dysfunctional family novel, you know, friends squabbling, spouses squabbling and all that, it's all, and I read a lot in the genre, it's starting to look a lot alike. And what I look for, I'll put it a different way. When I was starting, one of my mentors was Donald E. Westlake, who invented the comic.
Amazing.
Yeah, and a nice guy, too, and just brilliant in his conversation. And Don invented the comic caper novel and things like The Fugitive Pigeon and Bank Shot. But he also, you know, did, as you're aware, did a lot of very noirish novels about a professional thief named Parker, writing, and Don was writing as Richard Stark. But what one day when Don was very gracious about giving me advice, and he said, go on down to your bookstore and read the first page of all the books that came out this month. Whatever kinds of books. And he said, you quickly realize that if we want to use 100 as a number, that 95 of these authors sound alike. And that if you didn't have a title page and an author page, it would look like the same author was very prolific. But that 5 of those authors would not only be distinct from the 95, but they would be distinct from each other. And that, he said, was how you have a career. And so, you know, at a time when the unreliable narrator is starting to almost become a joke, I was just impressed by a crime novel, a noir novel. I'm speaking particularly about the new book, Broken Ground, because that's what we would like people to buy today, is that I felt it was not a genre book. You know, a noir book, a crime novel that's not a genre novel is a rare bird.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my favorite musicians, for instance, you know, they've always been the ones that kind of, you know, I started out playing music, but the ones that aren't necessarily straight rock, but, you know, they're rock and a little bit of country, or they're, you know, kind of almost blending genres. And if I were to describe what I do, I'd say it's, you know, literary thriller, which is, you know, a strange niche. I'm not sure you really, really want it. But, you know, I think Russell Banks' Affliction would fall into that category, and he's certainly a big influence, and I leaned heavily on, you know, that sort of landscape. But, yeah, I mean, I grew up with literary fiction. I wanted to write literary fiction. It wasn't until I went to Florida International University, where I studied under James W. Hall and Les Standiford, and you know,
I know Les. He's Florida a terrific guy.
Oh, my God. He's such a sweetheart. I mean, and working with him was amazing. And they took me aside. I was like, listen, you can make some money if you know, right now you already have a noir feel to your work. You know, if you just twist it a little more, you can write in the genre and you'll have kind of a built-in fan base. And that was really, it was great advice because I've been able to get a career out of it by playing to that, you know, that hand. But I also, you know, I'm a literary fiction guy. I mean, that's kind of in my blood. So,
what I would, one way maybe to do that, you were talking about literary thrillers. I think if it is a different way to pitch, say, Broken Ground, was called it literary noir. and, you know, really get precise about what this is. And in fact, do you watch TCM every Saturday night, Sunday morning? They have Noir Alley. Do you ever look at that?
I mean, I've watched every year they have the Noir Festival, and Eddie Mueller's out here.
Yeah,
and
good old Eddie. Wife and I are addicted. And what he makes, the films themselves and then Eddie Mueller's introductions all, you know, show that even when a noir film might not be as good as others, they have some degree of integrity that is somehow inherent in the genre. And I was feeling the same thing with the series, and particularly with Broken Ground.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the definition of the word noir is such a tricky thing, right? I mean, you're always hearing, you know, every day somebody's got a new definition of the word, a new piece on the internet. Somebody's trying to describe it is what it is. You know, I always like the Lehane definition about, you know, it's kind of the working class tragedy where, you know, you're falling down from, you know, the gutter, you know, a little bit further. But
yeah,
the word feels a little loaded right now, and so I'm a little leery of it, although
I hear
you. You know, I mean, that's what I do. Yeah, you know,
you know,
it's definitely what I do.
You're reminding me, when I was at the University of Iowa, I don't think I could get away with it now, but when I was at the University of Iowa teaching in the English department for a couple of times, I was allowed to teach. Now, the name these days you wouldn't get away with in the current climate, but it was called the tough guy novel. You'd have to call it noir novel now, right? But it was, and we started with Black Mask magazine and went up through Hammett and Chandler, and particularly James M. Cain, who is the writer, one of three prose writers that I learned the most from. And moving up even into people like Charles Bukowski, who's kind of like alcoholic noir, I just love the genre. It's one of those courses that I got like 250 people every time I taught it. I loved it.
Yeah, the actual quote that I meant to it was Dennis Lehane's Shakespeare. Men fall from thrones, and noir, they fall from the gutter, which I just love.
Yeah.
I didn't go to school with him, but he studied at the same university. So Lehane certainly was a big influence on what I do.
Yes, I would agree.
Yeah.
Joe, yeah, I'd like to kind of turn the tables and give you the microphone right now. I know in preparation for this interview, you felt like you had to read just about everything that David wrote.
I did a lot of David Morrell reading. Yeah.
But there's a there,
I wanted
there,
to be
but there's
well versed and ready.
Every
An awful
single
lot.
One of yeah, David's books are all so different, and the writing is so crisp and clean. Perhaps you could go ahead and talk about his books to him for us, please. And I'm going to get away from the microphone now.
No,
sure.
Jump
in. I feel like it's important to set. I feel like it's important to set this up a little bit, and I mean, I don't mean to be too personal. I know you've heard this story, David, but the last year of my life has been the hardest of my life. I lost my brother. My brother was my best friend. He died at 43 of alcoholism, and you know, it's something to this day I'm still dealing with, and a while, because we were really, you know, he was my brother. But the nice part about the story, the uplifting part, the part where you're going like, wow, that, you know, some serendipity in this world, is the last conversation my brother had. He slipped into a coma. He drank some, he slipped into a coma. And the last conversation we had on this earth was, I had talked to him, listen, David Morrell just agreed to blurb my novel. And he was like, holy shit, Rambo. And so we're going back and forth, and we're having this, you know, just goofy brother dialogue. And the last thing he said to me was, I said, you know, Johnny, it's over. His last thing he said was, nothing is over. And then he slipped into a coma a couple days later, and he died. I didn't know he was sick at that point. Anyway, fast forward, my sister's saying, you know, we gotta put something on his tombstone. What should we put on his tombstone? So I say, boom, nothing is over. It's the last thing he ever said to me. And it comes from you. It comes from Rambo. And so to be talking to you now and doing an interview with you now, it's surreal to me. I get choked up every time I tell the story, because it's, you know, that's the last thing he's ever said to me, and that's now on his tombstone. It was just put in yesterday. So, yeah,
it's a powerful, powerful story. You know, there's a in the grief community, because I spent a lot of time giving talks to grief groups. There's a saying, to be remembered is to be immortal. And that's a version of what's on that tombstone. Nothing is over. As the more you think about them, the more it's sentimental. But I find it to be very true for my son and my granddaughter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I read about that, that was even more. It's a brother's not going to be the same thing as a son. I can't imagine and how you've done that. And I read about that, and geez.
To go back, because we've opened this subject again in the grief community. the saying is that the death of a child is the death of the future. The death of a spouse is the death of the present, and the death of the parent is the death of the past. So in a way, that can apply to your brother. The death of your brother was the death of the present. And they're all different. There's no way to compare. Every grief is different and powerful. You can't compare, but I understand what you're saying.
And let me ask you, if this isn't too personal, what did you find writing after? When you went back to writing, how did you feel that helped you in the process of understanding the loss, coming to terms with it?
I wrote a book about grief called Fireflies, and it's a book about what it was like to be in the intensive care ward with a dying child. And I wrote it for me primarily because I was trying to understand. It's one of those, I don't believe what happened. I can't adjust to it. This isn't real. It didn't happen. And there's an American writer named John Barth, who was very, very powerful and important in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. He doesn't write anymore. And he wrote a novel, a first-person novel, in which somebody had been through a great catastrophe and was given the task by what amounted to a psychoanalyst, but to write something called scriptotherapy, which was essentially to use writing to try to understand himself by writing about the character, writing about the catastrophe that had happened to him. And basically I did the same thing with Fireflies. I was just trying to make myself believe, because I had difficulty with my son believing that it had happened. I refused to accept it. I denied it. And then all kinds of psychological problems start, because once you try to fight reality, you know who's going to win. So the book Fireflies was very helpful. And what I didn't expect was that indirectly, that the book would wind up helping other people in grief. And it's been a book. I got more letters about Fireflies than I did about anything I'd written, including the Rambo books, because the intensity with which I wrote about grief and my attempt to adjust to it spoke to a lot of people who were in the same position. Among other things, I was at that time, this is the late 80s, because of what had happened to my son, I was having massive panic attacks 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day. And I was barely functional, except that I was able to write about it. And I think that the fact that I was writing about panic attacks made other people admit that they had them, and to understand what caused them, and then try to figure out what to do about them. So it's a book that I'm very proud of, because I think it had a social impact for a group that that it was worth talking to about things that otherwise weren't talked about.
No, and it's funny. I don't know if you recall in Broken Ground how many panic attacks Jay has, but I'm writing about me. We found out my brother was sick, but then we were led to believe he was going to be okay. I think on the inside I knew he wasn't. But last year I had panic attacks the same thing, 2-3 times a day. And once he passed, the panic attacks went away. I think your body and mind knows what's going on. You're fighting it, and since then, the panic has abated, which is strange.
And when you start to fight it, as I said, when it's a contest with reality, we know who's going to win. And I often thought that, you know, in my case, it was because I just, you know, didn't want to face up to the immense actuality that had happened. And in your case, it sounds, you know, much the same. It's a complicated thing.
Yeah, and you know, and the two biggest emotions I know, you know, experience with that sort of thing is, you know, regrets and guilt, and certainly in my brother's case, you know, given, you know, Junkie Love, I go into this more, but, you know, I was kind of the one who got him started on a lot of things. So even though, you know, when I pulled away and turned my life around, there's this sense of survivor's guilt that I left, you know, a brother behind, you know, figuratively and literally. So that's not something you get over.
When I was learning to write, just before you came on, Pam and I were talking about how I'd gone to Penn State because of a professor, Philip Young, who'd written a wonderful book about Hemingway. And while I was there, I met the first professional writer I'd ever crossed paths with, whose name, in fact, was Philip also, Philip Klass, and whose pen name was William Ten, and he'd been a noted science fiction writer in the 50s. And I say all this just to set up one of the things that he taught me that I clung to as the truth about my career, and why, as Pam mentioned earlier, although my books are action and suspense novels, we're attempting to be real, they tend to have different subjects. And the reason for that was that Philip Klass, William Ten, had a theory that we all have a dominant emotion. And often we do not want to admit what that dominant emotion is because it isn't one that we want to have, or it's one that we want to hide. What he said to me after a number of one-on-one sessions was, your dominant emotion is fear. And that's what you should write about. And in fact, I did. And the fear came from when I was a kid, and my mother and my stepfather fought so much that I used to sleep under the bed telling stories to myself. That fear stayed with me up until when my son died, and then my dominant emotion changed. And where I'm going with this is that you mentioned a lot of very strong emotions. And that's what I admire, one of the things I admire about your books, and we'll just say the title once more, Broken Ground, that the reality of the emotions and your willingness to analyze them, or dramatize them is a better word, is somewhat rare in thriller fiction today, where action is emphasized sometimes more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've never had, you know, I liked, you know, fast action but even just rereading, you know, First Blood again, I was struck by how, you know, obviously there's a lot of action, but there's, you know, what's going on, you know, the real underlying story there are two diametrically opposed philosophies, almost a generational gap between Tiso and Rambo, and watching, you know, the way, because, you know, the movie's wonderful. I love the movie. But what's different in the book, of course, is that you have two almost, there's not really a tilt towards Rambo being the sympathetic figure. I mean, I'm awful sympathetic towards Tiso because he's not a bad guy, you know,
Denny's
awesome in the movie. But in the book, he's you have two people, right? It's almost that, what's that story, you know, like there's your story, my story, and the truth. And both these guys are coming from it where they're both in the right, and they could almost, you could almost get the sense there's, you know, there's time where they could get along, you know, where Rambo's coming back and going like, you know, the guy, you know, of course I understand how he feels. Look at me. I'd feel that way too. And there's a sense, that split second where he can walk away and this whole thing end. But his desire to stay has less to do with his hatred of Tiso. It has more to do with the fact that he has to fight a fight. So,
right,
you know, in that sense, he's the one who's almost responsible. Is, you know, in the movie, you know, he's just being abused and abused. And I understand why you do it in Hollywood, because, you know, you're breaking things down. But that nuance in the book is brilliant. And that's what drew me to it. And that was one of the first books I ever read. I mean, I had to be I didn't read. I have to admit, when I was a kid, I didn't read much because they told me in school you got to read, and I was a rebel. So
yeah,
you say read, I'm not going to read. But that was one of the books I picked up and, you know, read more than once, which was very rare for me. I'd forgotten that element because, you know, years have gone by. But revisiting it, that was really cool to see how you did that. Because I think, you know, what it comes down to, everybody's the hero in their own story. Nobody wakes up thinking they're the villain.
Exactly.
I would argue that maybe Dick Cheney might know he's a villain. I'm pretty sure Dick Cheney knows he's evil.
Yeah.
But everybody else in this world, I think, wakes up thinking they're in the right. And that's what's terrifying, because nobody's trying to do bad. They're trying to do the right thing. And when you get that in fiction, you know, there's an element of truth, you know, ethos that's true you're not going to get anywhere else.
And that's what fiction can do. I get very upset with bureaucrats who say all we should teach in schools is technology and practical skills, and that the arts have no value and novels have no value. When in fact, novels generally are the only way we can learn empathy. It's the only way we can, through the hypnotic power of a novelist, it's the only way a reader can be taken out of that individual's locked-in perspective and step into another individual's viewpoint in order to see the world in a different fashion. And when I was writing First Blood, the breakthrough in the technique was to alternate the viewpoints, so that I would have one chapter from Rambo's point of view and then another chapter from Teasel's point of view, then back to Rambo's point of view and then to Teasel's point of view. And while we were in each of their points of view, they would seem reasonable. But when we went into the other point of view, that would seem reasonable. And of course, it mirrors what was happening in the United States at the time, to show that where we get in trouble, where the disaster starts, is when we refuse to consider someone else's viewpoint. And you know, just to hit it hard, to say it again, a novel is the only way in which we can get into someone else's viewpoint and be hypnotized into believing it. You can't do it in a movie. And no other artwork will do it. So I have what you're saying is, I think, really speaks to what I was trying to do in that novel. I would just say one more thing, going back to this dominant emotion that I referred to. I thought of it as a dysfunctional father-son story, that in a fashion, Teasel was the stepfather I did not like. And that Rambo was the disobedient, the willful child, if you would, who refuses to stand up to the adult giving the orders. And the movie changed that. As you said a minute ago, it's a generational thing in the novel. But in the movie, Sylvester Stallone and Brian Dennehy were roughly the same age. So it was now dysfunctional brothers rather than dysfunctional father-son in a metaphoric way. But, I mean, and this all goes back to the dominant emotion, because why was I writing that book? To try to get rid of all these bad emotions that I felt still from when I was a kid.
Yeah, and I think that comes across, in the number of times Rambo's referred to as a kid was another thing that struck out. You don't really think about it, but I understand why you do things like that in movies, because it's just, you know, you have 2 hours and you're kind of stripping it down. Everything gets, you know, it's why when I'm teaching, I often use movies to teach, because it's much easier to explain what's going on with the plot. You know, there's so much more novel, there's so much more nuance in the novel, and it's not as easy to convey that information to students learning about how plot works or how this works. It's almost a simplified art form, not that it's not wonderful.
One of the things about movies that is, from a writing point of view, because dialogue in movies is so different from dialogue in novels, that you almost have to have a little class to explain, hey, don't write like in the movies, because they repeat names every three lines of dialogue, and in a novel, that's pretty awful. But what the study of a movie can do is teach you three-act structure. And it used to be television would show you that too. But since Hill Street Blues and that format of segmented stories related to a theme rather than to a three-act structure, a lot of the stuff we get on TV is just, in a way, one thing after another rather than one thing building on another. And movies at least still have that a structure which can teach somebody how to put a book together.
Well, speaking of TV, I got to tell you, I want to say wasted because it's been very enjoyable, but I've spent many afternoons shirking my writing responsibility to catch up on Route 66, which I got from you. And
well,
there's one scene, I think it's the one, God, I wish I could remember the episode now because I watched many of them, but they're in that little town, and the town doesn't want anybody in the town. It might even be the pilot. I don't know if it's the pilot.
It's
but the
pilot.
Want anybody
it's
in the town.
It's called Black November. I'm a walking encyclopedia of Route 66, and for as you know, and as Pam knows, but some of your listeners might not know, that Route 66 in a way changed my life because I was basically not heading in a good direction when I was a kid, and Route 66, the characters, there's something about them that made me think I was them and that their voyage across the United States, even though I was in Canada, was my voyage. And then I found out that the same man wrote almost every screenplay or teleplay, Sterling Siliphant, and, you know, another one of my male father surrogates. I wrote a letter to Sterling. A gracious librarian showed it was able to get me the address for Screen Gems, which is where Route 66 was distributed, and he encouraged me, and Route 66 changed my life, and continues to be one of those touchstones I come back to again and again, a mixture of fascinating plots and action mixed with really important ideas.
Yeah, very timely. And what's the other one that stood out was the gang one.
People are going to say, doesn't he have anything better to do than memorize titles? It was called Most Vanquished, Most Victorious. It was in the spring of the first season. And it's in the slums of L.A., and it's Todd and Buzz, the two main guys, against a really vicious street gang.
Wasn't that episode banned? I remember there was some kind of fallout with it. There was trouble with the censors.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. What happened was the at that time, the Congress, our blessed politicians, decided that television, like comic books before that, were just so disastrous for young people, and so Sterling's script for that episode of Route 66, Most Vanquished, Most Victorious, was discussed and condemned as what was wrong with television at that time. And, you know, here we are still talking about that episode and how remarkable and emotive and important it was. So, and all those bag of wind politicians, they're all gone away by now, but, you know, Route 66 endures.
And then we've got a new crop of politicians.
Well, we don't want to go. We've got to be civil. Otherwise, you know, my shock of coming back from the Victorian world.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to send you the shock. No, it's great. You know, with the Sterling story. When I was homeless, as Pam mentioned, I was. You don't get a lot of reading options in the gutter because, you know, my friend Tom Pitt says, you know, your reading sucks and sucks when your library is the gutter. The only books you could read were the books you found literally on the street. But there was a day I picked up Jerry Stahl's Permanent Midnight, and that was the book. I read it in a couple of days, and I would carry it with me everywhere. And it was a book I said, wow, I can do this. If I can get off the street, if I can put my act together, I can do this. I can be a writer. And so one of the highlights of my life was years later, you know, way down the road, is I got to read on stage with Jerry Stahl. In fact,
that's cool.
Just a short anecdote. Well, here's a great short anecdote, and this is really just no. This here's the part that's chilling. This is so I'm reading with Jerry Stahl down in at the last bookstore, and in the audience is my old drummer because you know we're talking like 15 years ago drummer, and she's in the audience. She flew all the way from Virginia just for a reading. And I was like, after the thing, I'm like, thanks so much for coming, Gina. Like, it means a lot, but why would you come out for a reading? She goes, you probably remember this. When you were at your worst, and you were, you know, I thought you were going to die, you had that book with you all the time. You said, someday I'm going to read on stage with this man.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I wasn't going to miss this for the world. So she flew 3,000 miles just to see this reading I did, which was really, really cool. But, yeah, it's moments like that that you're like, geez, you know, maybe it's all connected. If there's some kind of greater order that, you know, gives you some faith.
Well, one of the things that I'm taking from what you said is the redemptive, getting back to, you know, why we need to teach the arts and why we need to teach novels, because that's you and I, it's what we do, is the redemptive quality that novels present, that novels can change our lives, that they can reorient the way we think and feel and show us thoughts and emotions we never imagined and set us on a course that wouldn't otherwise have been possible. I'm really inspired by your story and the way that it weaves in to your books. And it might be that's what gives them that sense of realism. But on the other hand, you know, it's about how you write. It's what's your approach to writing? Like, how many do you work every day? How many hours do you try to put in? How does the nuts and bolts of it?
I tend to binge and purge. I write two novels a year. Two novels a year.
I wish
I write the
J.P.
book. And I write the. Well, I'm very fortunate to be able to do this full time, and just my life circumstances and whatnot. You know, this is my full time job. Until my brother passed, I was pretty rabid about how much I was writing. I've sort of been a little out of sorts since then. Although I finished one book in the meantime, but I was doing two books a year, and so that's when I had the down and out three book deal. I had three books that I'd written that I've been trying to play, so they're gonna be coming out. So 3 years, I have two books coming out a year. I have three books this year, which is pretty awesome. But generally,
awesome.
I write in the morning. I write in the morning, and then I work out. And then in the afternoon, I tend to do my job because that's where my brain cells don't work. And then when I'm on a good streak, I will work all night, much to my poor wife's. We've had plenty of dinners where my wife is like, you know, all right, you're in it again. I can see the glazed over look in your eyes. You're somewhere else because you know how that is when you're writing. You're in that world. That's where you live. And it's a strange thing. Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl, has this great quote I love. Who she was saying after she was writing Gone Girl, which is, you know, pretty out there in terms of wacky protagonists, she had to leave herself a note saying, leave the craziness upstairs, because she's coming downstairs and taking it out on her husband. And
well,
I've certainly
funny.
Done that. You know, there's been times my wife is like, stop acting like Jay Porter. Like, because I'm not Jay Porter, but Jay's kind of a dick. He's got a little dick, more dickish qualities than I have. And I will start to adopt that mannerism. It takes a while to forget, wait a second, that's not my life. I'm not that guy. I'm over here. My life's actually pretty good. I got a great wife, got great kids, you know.
It can be a form of method acting. And actually, you remind me, I'm just going to go back with Gone Girl and Gillian Flynn. My remarks recently about all the unreliable first-person narrators do not apply to her and her book, because that was the start of the trend, so to speak. And I thought it was a wonderful book. In fact, it was so wonderful everybody wanted to write the same book, and that's the trouble we're in now. One of the big places in recent thriller fiction, along with the girl with the spider tattoo, and before that, the Da Vinci Code.
Well, you have all these titles. Another girl gone, girl missing.
I am sitting here listening to an amazing conversation by David Morrell and Joe Clifford about writing. And interesting to an observation to you both, you know, you both write such different stories. And yet, here you are coming from different backgrounds and different histories and so on. You have such commonality in the reasons that you write, the things that you like about writing and reading. It's very exciting to me to listen to this. We are almost out of time, but I want to, first of all, ask David, when is your book going to be released, do you think?
Oh, who the heck knows? That's what I said to Joe. I said, I wish I could... I'm you know, this is like the eternal book. What happened to me is that I used to write until recently on the basis of what we could call narrative thrust, that one scene led to another and another, and the
yes.
story finally ended. But for some reason lately, I and I'd heard about this and I didn't understand it, but it's happening to me. I write scenes that I think the book needs, but they're not in the right place. So I wind up with like 12 scenes, and I don't know what order to put them in, and this has never happened to me before. It's just, it's maddening. So I have no idea. I really have no idea. But as I said before Joe came on the program, the event that happened to me was so emotional and positive and meaningful that I want to make sure I get this thing right so that I do justice to the topic. So I'm being very patient about it.
Good.
And I'm working
glad.
Every day. I'm working every day. It's just that where I used to be able to do 5 pages a day, if I can get 2 done readable, it's an achievement.
Listen, it's all an achievement.
Can I ask you real quick,
Go ahead, Joe.
Such a fan of Creepers, and I know it was in development, and then you said that was being held up in terms of a film, but can you tell me what the latest on it is?
Yeah, Creepers is a novel from 2005. It's about urban explorers, about people who sneak into old buildings that have been abandoned for a very long time and want to sort of disappear into the past, which I guess is one of my big themes. And it sold to the movies, not sold, it was optioned. I have to make a distinction here. It was optioned in 2007 and it has been re-optioned and re-optioned and re-optioned every year since then. In a way, you know, it's good. I'm getting some income out of it, but it'd be nice to actually get the movie made. And it's currently at a stage where I'm, you know, I hear little glimmers that maybe it's actually going to start, but nothing firm yet. But if I had to predict, I'd say 90% sure that maybe within the next year it'll go into production.
Well, that'd be nice. And we're
talking about unreliable narrators, and that's an example of where, you know, there's just enough where you're wondering what's the PTSD, the line you skirt in that is just remarkably brilliant.
The,
you know,
the narrator
kind of,
it's a third-person limited narrator, but it's constant. It's always the same guy. But this guy is even lying to himself, and this is way, way before. I wouldn't know if I'd call it unreliable, but the character changes.
No,
he morphs 3 times.
No,
interesting.
No, he's just off enough. It's just off enough. You reread it and you go, wait a second, did that happen? It's a brilliant.
Yeah,
to stay on the line, I can't imagine, because it's such a fine line to walk, and you do it brilliantly.
Joe, are you touring for Broken Ground, or what is going to happen next for you with Jay Porter?
So the single greatest event in my writing career, and this is going to sound pretty small, but my old high school reached out to me, and they're flying me back in October to speak to the entire school in 2 separate assemblies. With the best part about this is that my guidance counselor said, and I quote, not that I'm harboring any resentment, but I will remember this forever, don't waste your parents' money by going to college. You're not going to amount to anything. So just that juxtaposition with we're going 30-something years later to come back to that same high school being asked to read is one of those really
my
cool,
high school
cool moments.
Principal told me the same thing. He said, you're never going to amount to anything. So
wow.
We do have a lot in common. That's a very cool story.
That's a really cool story.
So I'm doing that in
but
yeah.
prior to that, I think that next month you both will be in New York City for Thriller Fest, where I will also be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
terrific. And so I get to see 2 of my favorite writers and 2 of my friends again for Thriller Fest July 12th through the 15th at the Hyatt Grand Central. This Thriller Fest is the highlight of everything that International Thriller Writers has done for writers throughout the world. David, when you first started this with Gail, did you think International Thriller Writers would become this powerhouse and important and absolutely necessary entity that it is now?
Not at all. There were about the figure varies in my memory, but I seem to recall there were about 86 people that showed up for the initial meeting at VoucherCon in Toronto, I believe in 2007. It could have been a little earlier. And it was just Gail and I and some very helpful people. If I start mentioning everybody, then I'm going to miss somebody, and then they're going to be unhappy. But an attorney named David Dunn, who is also a budding thriller writer, was generous enough to donate his law offices for us to use them as a base, and he donated at a reasonable price his staff to work for us, and he drew up the bylaws and things, and we wouldn't be in business if it weren't for David Dunn, whom I haven't seen in years, but you know, kudos and thanks to him and a lot of other people, but you know, I guess we have a membership of a couple of thousand now, and we've helped a lot of people earn a living, which was part of the idea that the people would be able to get the tools to be able to know how to, you know, get their books into the right hands to be published and what to do with them afterward in terms of attracting readers. So it's been quite a ride, and makes me smile about the talking about the ability to affect lives in a positive way.
Well, I have to say that my second year as a radio talk show host, I was in New York and had my ratty old copy, literally the ratty copy of Brotherhood of the Rose. It was the
yeah.
cover was taped together.
I remember.
And John Land introduced me to the professor. As a matter of fact, that's how I always called Joe, because John Land called him professor, and said, John said to me laughingly, "Pam, for crying out loud, go over to the book room. You can get a new copy." I was horrified. I thought,
yeah.
"No, this is the book that I've read probably by now 20 times." And David was so gracious to sign it. And at that time, Shimmer was just out, and you gave me a copy of that and signed that too.
Oh.
Since that time, I've not had a chance to go back, but I remember standing in front of David Morrell with tears in my eyes thinking, oh, my God, this is my literary hero, and he's talking to me. That is what Thriller Fest has done for me and opened the doors for so many wonderful writers to come on this show. And just as a side note, last time David was on this show, it was with the executive director of Thriller Fest, the lovely KJ, Kim Howe, where we
yeah.
talked about, as a matter of fact, I think she interviewed you, David.
I think that's
and
the
then
case, yes.
Yes, and then in another series of firsts, the first VoucherCon I was able to attend, I met Joe and was introduced to the noir community, who have been so gracious to me and have allowed me to kind of learn about noir and pulp and that noir crime fiction that I was so unaware of. I didn't know there was a category like that, or a subgenre, I guess I should say. Who knew that all the books that I was reading early in my adult life were noir, and we just knew it was fiction,
who
romance,
knew?
Or nonfiction. You know, that's all I knew. So Joe generously has been on my show several times, and we always have a good time. I'm looking forward to seeing you both. David, if people want to find out more about you, where should they go look for you on the webs?
DavidMorrell.net. Not com, but .net. It's like the network of readers, and there's a ton of information there. I also have a Facebook in a kind of a magazine style. It's an interesting site. It's designed in an interesting way. I also have a Facebook page, an author's page, not a friend's page. And on it, I try to post something every day about books, movies, and music. It's that professor in me. I talk about what I'm reading or what I'm watching or what I'm listening to. People often use my recommendations for directions that they'd like to go in. And that today I did something about Joe's new book, Broken Ground. And I just want to emphasize that if you're interested in a crime novel, we've been calling it noir, but we can call it a number of different things, but one that feels real, that has that is in fact that has an atmosphere that you'll feel that you're in, that isn't like everything else, and that is, I think, important, please buy the book and enjoy it.
Yeah,
and
this
Joe,
has always been the interesting thing to me about noir writers, is we write about, you know, crime and horrible things and horrible people doing bad things, right? But as a person, everybody I meet, David, Pam, everybody in this community are some of the nicest people, the most giving and generous people. And both you guys are terrific examples of that. Pam, you've been nothing but a tireless advocate. David, since I've known you, you've been nothing but generous and giving. So thank you both, and I really appreciate that.
We're all in this together.
Where can we find you on the web, Joe?
JoeClifford.com, your one-stop shop for all your Joe Clifford needs. That's where I am. Easy to find, and I am not saying I sit around Googling myself, but if I were, I am now the number one Joe Clifford. I recently beat Joe Clifford Faust, so I'm pretty excited about
there
that.
There you go.
I know it's a little sad, but
I want to extend an invitation for you both to come back. David, perhaps when your book is released, you and Joe would come back again, and I want to be able to talk about that book, but I also would be very interested, because you both are musicians and music lovers, and Joe, I'm going to have to send you the link where David and I talked about Frank Sinatra for one whole period.
We did.
It was an amazing
hour.
It was an amazing conversation. David has written a book on Frank Sinatra, and it's a very unique perspective. So I'd like to invite you both back and
talk about music.
And talk about music and David's new book. And also, I will see you both at Thriller Fest. You have no idea how grateful I am that you both were here. Thank you so very much.
Hey. It was a good time.
I
don't know.
Hey,
the first drink's on me at Thriller Fest. Please find me in the bar. I owe you both.
I think you will not be in the bar. So there you go.
There we go. The bar's too tiny. We will meet up for sure, though. Thank you so much for being with me. This is the literary event for me, and I appreciate
you're
it.
You're very kind.
And I look forward to seeing you both next month, okay?
Same here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening, everybody. I appreciate you being with me tonight. Stay tuned next week. Wednesday is Superstar Wednesday. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, everyone.